This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com.
Hi, Miss Anna David. Thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Why don't we start, as always, with you just telling everybody a little bit about you and what you do.
So I am a writer in recovery from traditional publishing, and now I'm a book publisher, and I'm also an addict in recovery from alcoholism and addiction for 23 years.
I love that you're in recovery from publishing.
Traditional publishing,
right. Okay, well, now you have to elaborate on what does that mean? Like, obviously, I would assume there are just pieces of that world that don't fit so well, maybe personality-wise, or what does that mean? Why are you recovering?
Well, traditional publishing is just trauma-inducing. And honestly, if you ask anybody who's done it, they will say the same thing. My book career started in 2005. I sold my first book to HarperCollins. And then I did five more book deals with Harper, and one with Simon & Schuster. And the way the book business works is they basically, most books are loss leaders. So they know if a book hits, it's going to make so much money that they can afford to lose money on 95% of their books. And they don't tell you that. So you come in, they've paid you, they're giving you all this attention, and you really don't learn until the launch that you were not one of them. And I know book publicists who worked at big five companies who say, we're told to lie to most of our writers, because what are they going to say? We don't value you, but they don't. And it's not because they're evil, it's because they're a business. And I think with creative projects, we get so into, we think ours is so important and so good that we forget it is a business. So it's kind of set up to make you fail. And there are studies about how the mental health of first-time authors especially just deteriorates around their launch. Because you're so devastated that you've spent years working towards your dream and it just kind of fizzles out, which is why I started my company 7 years ago, because what we do is we take all the elements of traditional publishing that I learned, but clients pay us. We give them tons of love and attention and we educate them. We tell them everything. And our books are not meant, you know, in traditional publishing, you are told you have to hit certain sales numbers and all of these things, and they're really hard to hit. We always say, it doesn't matter how many books you sell, your book is to build authority, your book is to get clients. So you'd rather have 100 of the right people reading it than 10,000 of the wrong people.
Yeah, for sure. Same thing, podcast world, social media, all of it, business. I mean, it's all kind of the same. You want to have the really great engaged people that really fit your thing rather than millions of people that don't really care about your thing or what you're doing or who you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what do people, I hear this all the time. I get asked all the time when I'm writing my first book. And I am not, this is not an announcement to my audience. That is not happening yet. But I do have people all the time talk about self-publishing. Angela, what are the best ways to promote? And those sort of things. What would you tell people who are writing a book and self-publishing? Like, especially if you don't have a major social media following or a podcast with a huge following, like, what is that process like? Because I see all these companies too that Like I even got pitched a couple times from companies that were 25,000. One was 40,000, like to do your book and promote it and all the things. What would you tell people to watch for?
First of all, for high level, that's, you know, yeah, our packages start at 22 and go up to 150. So that's not bad. Mm-hmm. The problem is a lot of those companies, I don't think there are any others where the founder comes from traditional publishing. They're sort of people who are like, you can make all this money in book publishing. I think the most important thing is, get professional help. You do not have to hire a company like at this level at all. We're for a super specific clientele and we don't pitch at all. We take a tiny percentage of the people that reach out to us, but get professional help because it's like, if you don't write every day, all day, and you haven't for a decade, you are not going to do as good a job as a professional. Doesn't mean you need to have a ghostwriter, but get someone to start you at least in the beginning, because you need to get really clear about your who, your what, and your why. Who is this book for? What do you want your reader to do when they finish reading it? And why? Why are they reading your book? And if you can answer those, you can find people. I don't think this is a controversial thing to say. I don't think it makes sense to write a book unless and publish a book unless you have a service where people can hire you, because it is so much work or, as discussed, so much money that you better have a plan to earn back 10 to 100 times that. Or it's wonderful to write a book to help people. I absolutely love it when I get emails saying how much my books have helped people. But I did 6 books to help people and I was left unable to pay my rent. So that is not a good life plan.
Right. It's not a good business plan.
No.
And I think that's a great point too, because self-publishing is really easy, but I would say, and everything you said, like that really is, those are the things that have held me back at this point is I don't even have that clarity, right? I feel like there's 4 books floating around in my head and I don't have the clarity of what I want to start with and what the point of it is. Like, I'm just not there yet. So I really appreciate you saying that and giving that guidance, because it is, you can go on Amazon, you can write a book and go on Amazon and publish it, right? There's all kinds of, all kinds of services that will print your book and do the whole thing. But yeah, if you don't have an idea of what you're doing it for, or also I think, and I know you'll relate to this for sure, and so many people in my audience will too, you aren't going to invest so much time in something, I don't think, if you don't have the plan. Like there has to be a something, especially as a busy person. You're talking about you've got a baby and you've got a business. And like, I don't have just a ton of hours to put into something just because, you know, like that's what my journal is for.
Exactly. And the problem is, most people who write books are writing quote unquote journals because no one's reading them but them.
Right.
And you know, that's why one of the things we offer actually, and this is like not a pitch at all, is we have an outline process where you can just hire us to have an hour long call and we'll do the outline for your book. And then you can go and take it and go do your thing. But you need someone else's perspective to say, yes, this is your story. This is the one that you're both passionate about and will do something to help you and help other people.
Yeah. You just triggered all of this thought process for me too, even in recovery and in life and personal development, self-help, like all of it is you have to have an outside perspective. Like even when I got sober, I always say I couldn't fix my broken thinking with my broken thinking. Right. I needed another person to make sense of it all and to help me sort it all out, right? Like my head was not the place to sort out my head. So it's like with everything, you need that outside perspective.
100%. And I think, because I talk to people all the time who kind of, we fall so in love with our ideas that, and I mean, recovery is such a great analogy because we fall so in love with our thinking, even if our thinking's horrible, even if it's going to kill us, we can't differentiate because it's in our head. So I think also with creative projects, people get their egos involved and they think if they get help, it's going to lose some authenticity. But it's sort of like, I don't go running into a hospital and grab a scalpel and start trying to operate because I have no training. So why are people who have no training trying to do this for themselves?
Right. Yeah. Amen to that. Tell me about your recovery journey. Like, when did you realize that you had a problem that was significant enough that you needed to take some action?
That's a great question, because it's like denial is so pervasive that it's like you realize and then you're like, no, that was just a total overreaction. Everything's totally fine. Don't need to do anything. I was one of these people who was like very open about it being a problem, but I didn't think it was a problem that needed such a radical solution. So I think the time between really accepting that I needed to do something and actually getting help was pretty quick. I got sober in May of 2000, and it was the end of April where I was like, I don't know what happened that morning. I woke up, nothing was different. I just was like, I can't do this anymore. And I got honest and I was like in outpatient rehab the following week.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
So yeah. Cause for a lot of us, that's a long journey, right? Like, I knew for a couple of years that I really needed to quit drinking. Like, there was no question I was going to have to stop, but I couldn't get it together to do that or commit to it or figure out what that was going to look like. And oddly enough, those were my two worst years, like my hardest, most devastating, heartbreaking, self-loathing, you know, they were my worst and hardest years.
Of course. Same. And yeah, I mean, it was like, I made these half-hearted attempts, but like, you know, like I said, I would just sort of convince myself that I didn't really need to do anything about it.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, because it does feel really extreme. It does feel, I have these conversations too, when people want to do interventions, right? Doing an intervention on a family member, like, yes, it is extreme. It feels big. It feels dramatic. But that doesn't make it not necessary, you know? And when you go through that dance of, do I really have to quit like forever? Like, maybe I could just quit for a little while and then I'll be able to control it. Like, do I really need to go to AA? Is that where I'm at?
Right. Has it really gotten this low?
Yeah. Am I that bad?
Yeah.
I knew I was that bad. Like, even in my active drinking, I knew I was that bad. I had zero denial. I knew I was an alcoholic when I was drinking. Once I understood that was kind of at the core of all of my struggles, I was relieved by it. Where a lot of people freak out about that word, alcoholic. For me, I was like, oh, damn. Okay. Well, now I know what to do. Now I know where to go and I know who to ask for help. Like, this makes perfect sense.
Same. My TEDx talk is about embracing the label addict, because everybody thinks it's such a pejorative word. For me, I was like, I am. You mean all these cool, amazing people are also, because, you know, addicts and alcoholics are like the coolest, smartest, funniest people I know. And I'm 100%. Like, I'm that. And you're telling me I'm going to be restored to sanity. Awesome. I have totally been insane. I am not offended by that label. Bring on the solution.
I so appreciate you saying that, because I have caught myself a time or two recently feeling a little offended at people being so offended by the word alcoholic and addict. And I'm kind of like, F you, dude. Like, I can be whatever I want to be, you know, like this is who I am. It doesn't mean you need to use those words if you don't want to, but what's so bad about being me? Like, I'm my favorite person. I am so grateful to be me. And it is kind of offensive where people are like, oh, there's so much stigma. But it's like, that stigma is in your head. That's about your issues and your insecurity. Not everybody feels that. I wear the word alcoholic like a badge of honor, and I don't want anybody to try to take that from me. I'm very proud of that.
Same. And You know, I think a lot of it is just the culture we live in now, where there's so many words you can't say because they're offensive, and it gets ridiculous. And those people, the ones who are saying that alcoholic and addict are bad words, are the ones perpetuating the problem.
Right.
Because you're getting out there and saying it's a bad word. So people struggling are like, oh, that's a bad word. You know, I think it's tragic, and it's a really bizarre sort of, what, you know, what's the word I mean? Like, what, you know, the thing they're standing on. Like, it's a bizarre battle to pick. There are so many others, particularly about this cause, than to pick on the language.
Yeah. And I think too, like, listen, this is the beauty of living in a free country and having free will, is I can call myself whatever I want to. I can use whatever words I want to. Again, you don't have to use those words if you don't want. Like, I just saw this in a post maybe 2 weeks ago on Facebook, and somebody posted, can we please stop using the words alcoholic and addict? It's so archaic, and it's alcohol use disorder. And I'm like, first of all, that terminology is clinical, and that was for insurance billing purposes. That right. was never meant to be a thing. Like, we're not sitting in AA going, hi, everybody, I'm Angela, and I have alcohol use disorder. Like, just get over it. It's such a weird thing, just like you're saying. It's such a weird thing to get hung up on, but also to have some expectation that everybody do it the way somebody else deems appropriate, right? Like, I'm not judging anybody that wants to call themselves alcohol free. Like, I don't care, but I don't want to be judged because I'm okay being an alcoholic either.
Totally, totally. And it's kind of, I also feel the same way about, there are people who post on Instagram about how, like, how bad it is that things are advertised as, like, you know, for instance, like, I'm a new mom, like, whatever, the, you know, mommy wine culture. A lot of mommies can handle that. Like, yeah, right. I don't think that's bad to promote that to the people who can handle it. You can't blame the advertising for what's an internal problem.
100%. Yeah. And it is frustrating. I got frustrated a couple of years ago. My gym, in the little cafe in my gym, they started serving beer, and
certain weird combo.
I know, right? It's so weird. Yeah. I'm like, no, it's like, nowhere is safe anymore, you know. But it is, you're right. You have to keep it in perspective that people that can't handle it are a very, very tiny percentage of the population. And many, many other people can handle it just fine with no issues. So yeah, but you're right. It is an internal thing that has to be addressed internally. It's not about the advertising. Like, that's not going to make me drink. You know, is it weird that they promote certain beers as, like, health beers? Yeah, it's weird, but it probably works.
I mean, I thought, isn't there, I don't know the studies, but, like, doesn't wine help heart attacks? I don't even know. I've resigned from telling anybody else what they should do.
Right. Yeah. And that's the key, right? You just reminded me of the principle I learned in AA, but I'm sure it's everywhere. It's from the beginning of time. But, you know, like, stay on your side of the street.
Yeah.
You know, mind your own business. Like, don't worry about what other people are doing. Focus on yourself and what you need to do and what you need to fix and how you can be better and feel better. Like, stop worrying about what everybody else is doing or what words they're using.
100%.
Okay, so you got sober in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Were you already established in your career at that point, or did getting sober have some ripple effect?
Huge ripple effect. I was very established in getting fired, which unfortunately did continue through my sobriety. But no, I had worked at magazines, but I, you know, it hadn't gone so well. And then I will say, when I got sober, it felt like the universe had been kind of waiting to hand me these gifts, waiting for me to wake up and, you know, give me a lot of external things. I mean, it was like, I got my dream job. I suddenly was, like, you know, being courted to go on TV and all of these things that I had always kind of fantasized. And they happened very easily. That changed. You know, I think a lot of people's early sobriety is not like that. Mine was very magical. And I was like, now that I'm sober, I'm going to get everything I want. And I feel like when I got to about 5 years, it got a lot tougher and that stopped happening. And, you know, I don't know. It's like that thing where when something happens when you're young, that's a really great thing. If you have the kind of ego I have, you're like, well, of course everyone wants me to be on TV. Like, why would they not? Like I didn't realize I was getting, the universe gives you these big breaks. Usually, you know, doles it out, but I'm sure, I know it's different for some people. They get them over and over and over again. That has not been my situation. It was like, I got it. It was beginner's luck. And then it was a rude awakening when those gifts kind of stopped appearing so easily.
It's always a rude awakening.
It is.
And it is just the nature of life, right? Like there's going to be ups, there's going to be downs. Like the nature of life is just to throw curveballs. So yeah, it is an interesting journey. It sounds like it really challenged you too, though, like really challenged you to push through, to be better, probably to use a lot of the coping skills that you were learning as a sober person.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that thing. I was like very stubborn because it's like, I only change when I'm in so much pain that changing is less painful than staying where I am. I mean, it's like, I both hate and love change. I hate routine, but I kind of love it. You know, it's bizarre. So yeah, I think I definitely made things harder for myself than I've had to, you know, by not surrendering.
Story of my life. I always take the harder way, whether I realize it or not. I can so relate to that. Okay, so how did your sobriety help you in your professional life? Like once you got more established?
I mean, it helped so much. I was I would say my career before sobriety had been kind of ruled by alcoholism and not necessarily like drinking and doing drugs at work, though that did happen towards the end, but just that alcoholic ego and I'm the piece of crap in the center of the universe, like really acting from a place of like, I deserve everything, but are you going to hate me? You know, like, but you know, and I was incapable of actually working in an effective way. I really have struggled, you know, I, until I started my business, I had sort of been trying to work for other people. I will say I worked in publishing. It was a very dysfunctional business and it was a very different time. When I hear what people are upset about, you know, this generation, about the way they're treated at work, I can't even, I had phones thrown at me. I was like, I was told things like, oh, go sleep with that guy if you want, like, you know, a boss would tell me that, like the kind of thing that like, I reacted and I didn't respond. I didn't react well to that treatment. I would then respond and I would get fired. So yes, my attitude was terrible, but I also was in very abusive situations at work.
Mm-hmm. So when you had to get sober, what did you do? Like, did you go to treatment? You said you went to outpatient treatment. Like you realized you needed help and you did outpatient treatment. Was that enough?
It was enough for me. And I feel so lucky because I know that that's not the typical case. It brought me to 12-step and then I loved it. I did have some confusion over the fact that alcoholism and addiction are actually the same thing. To me, they didn't feel like it. And so when I had 6.5 months, I decided to experiment with that. And I did go out for a night to have a glass of wine and ended up taking 4.5 hits of ecstasy and then being like, okay, I get it. Like if I drink, I'll do drugs. And then if anyone has them. And then it was, you know, probably a year later where I was like, oh, I am a complete alcoholic. I had never used alcohol safely or sanely. And so, but since then, yeah, it's just, it's been what I've done. And I would say like, everything I know how to do, I learned in 12-step. Everything. Yeah. Everything from the emotional to the literal. I'm a public speaker. I learned how to do that in meetings. Right. I learned how to have relationships by learning to, you know, show up for sponsors. Everything I know how to do, I learned there.
I love those beautiful little lessons that you don't even attribute. You know, I say, like, I learned how to be on time.
Yep.
Going yes. to meetings, right? Like that yep. was a huge thing. I learned to be dependable from going to meetings and showing up, you know, for other people. When I said I would show up, it was so important, and to my sponsor, like just driving that into me. But I was so selfish and so self-absorbed. I just didn't have those skills. I was not capable of thinking outside myself to understand that being on time is important. Being dependable is important, you know?
Totally, totally. And it always trips me out. Like when I take a step back and think about it, like think about meetings. How insane is it that a group of people show up with no one in charge? There's no teacher. There's no boss. You just show up and it starts on time. Not this one, but millions all over the world. And like, yeah. that just works. That is so bizarre to me.
Yeah. But it only works because of the people that are showing up all the time consistently and leading the newer people. And have you found this in your recovery? Like, did you have a period? Because I feel like your motivation for continuing to go to meetings changes over time, right? Like, I didn't miss a meeting probably my first 5 years. I was there every single day, sometimes a couple of meetings in a day. I had my routines. My sponsor was there. My friends were there. I had a freaking blast. I loved going there. But what I needed in the first 5 years was very different from what I needed 5 years to 10 or 10 to 15 or 15 to 20, right? Your motivation changes. Did you have that same experience?
I did. What's interesting is I actually have a new sponsor, and she is talking about how we go to meetings to share the message of recovery. I think for many years, I've been using it as sort of group therapy, which is not what we are supposed to be doing there. Right. I don't know. I mean, I'm still pretty like selfish and self-absorbed. So I think I do go to feel better. I go because it's the sort of inspiration and positivity I need most days. And because of Zoom, I go pretty much every day, you know, because I leave my headphones on and I, you know, do other things, which to me counts. That is controversial. People say it doesn't count. It counts to me.
I think whatever you're doing counts, honestly, because yeah. it is different. I mean, Zoom has changed everything and COVID changed everything, you know, and it's not, listen, just to make the time to think, to do it, to put the headphones on and show up is huge. I know. Oh, yeah, it's big. Like you need to be there. I know. One of the things for me certainly was being there for the newcomer, right? Like I wanted to be in the room, especially as a female. I wanted to be in that room for the next girl that was coming in that felt the way I felt going to my first meeting, freaking out, where I walked into my first meeting and it was all men in their late 60s, early 70s, right? I was 33 when I got sober. So, I mean, it was hard, right? And it's nerve-wracking and it's terrifying. And like, I want to be the person sitting there that's just a regular human with a smile on my face, right? To make it feel not so terrifying.
Yeah, I need to focus more on that. I'm not great at it. And so that's something that, like, you know, like I said, I'm still very self-absorbed.
Yeah, I am too, in different ways. I think I just had a very strict sponsor that brought me up, so to speak, in a pretty strict way in AA and really pretty traditional and hard. Like my sponsor was hard on me, you know, and I love him for that. I needed that, you know, that is the best approach for me and how I learn best. So it was really good, but all my best lessons I've learned in those rooms, you know, changing my life and learning to be human and learning to be less selfish. And yeah, it's crazy. The value in those rooms is insane for it to not cost anything.
I know.
What would you say in the course of your sobriety, what would you say has been the most difficult thing that you've experienced, a life event, the most difficult thing in your sobriety, and how did you get through it without drinking?
I mean, I've had a lot of difficult things. And when I say difficult, I mean between my ears. I think by external standards, I've had a ridiculously easy life. But, you know, sobriety recovery has not been this like upward, it just gets better and better and better. Any change, I mean, even now being a new mom, the change in my life, I do believe I live with 100 forms of fear. My main fear is that as of being scared. So I get too scared to tell myself I'm scared. So then I just feel bad. And I wonder what's wrong with me. And if I could just sort of, quote unquote, be normal and just go, you know what? It's terrifying to be this age and to be responsible for another human being, no matter how much he delights me. And he does, but it's terrifying. And, you know, I was reading something the other day that I was talking to another new mom about is mourning isn't just for when someone dies. It's for a life change.
Yeah.
Through a period. And I think that, you know, alcoholics and addicts don't have feelings that are any more intense in many ways than other people, but we just prioritize them so much. My boyfriend, who's like super normie, it's like he has a feeling and he's just like, yeah, I feel mad or something. And it just passes. For me, it's like, I think I just blow it up and blow it up and I analyze it and I put a microscope on it. And then I, you know, and then it becomes like an external problem that feels insurmountable when nothing is wrong.
My whole audience is nodding their head right now.
But it's hard to say sometimes because it's like, especially when it's something that's like a dream come true that you've always wished for, it doesn't mean you feel amazing all the time.
Yeah, which is just the nature of life. We can't feel amazing all the time. It'd be nice, but it just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So what do you see in your next chapter?
I feel like the next chapter started with him. So let's say it started 7 months ago. It's interesting because right, you know, before he was born, I was like, I'm going to take a step back from work. And I kind of set up my business so that I didn't have to be as involved. And then it's weird because the first couple of months that was true. And then I don't know, maybe, you know, this is just the nature of work. It's like, well, no, I actually do have a lot to do every day. I mean, it was a little delusional that I could just have my team do everything. But I also honestly, you know, need variety in my life. So we are, you know, we're talking about moving to another place. I am also actively working on continuing to grow my business because, you know, I mean, the more I make, the more time I can spend with him as he grows.
Right.
So, and the more you see about the importance of like, oh, school and all these things. And so I'm also doing more speaking. I've kind of done that sporadically, but I'm really putting an emphasis on it. I want to do corporate speaking. And for the same reason, to be able to go somewhere, spread the message, make a lot of money in just a weekend, and then be able to spend more time with my family.
Yeah, freedom. It sounds like there's a freedom message in there, freedom of time and freedom of energy, which I think is kind of the same thing with recovery, right? When we're looking at getting sober, it's really looking for the freedom from that, from alcohol or whatever the thing is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're growing your business.
Mm-hmm.
It looks different than you thought it was going to because you can't have your team doing everything for you. What is the pivot? Like, how are you prioritizing? Like, okay, I'll sacrifice this time here to do these tasks, or I won't sacrifice this for this. Like, how are you prioritizing those things?
That's a great question. And it's interesting because it's what it is. And I was just saying this to somebody yesterday is like, it's so easy to get distracted by bright, shiny objects in your business.
Yes.
So it's like for 5 years, I'm like, I'm gonna build a funnel. I'm gonna have courses. I have tried and tried. I can't even tell you how many thousands of dollars and thousands of hours I've spent on that. Hope Springs Eternal. And it's like, no, you know what? We have not a very easy time, but it's like, it was harder for me to sell a $100 course than it honestly is for me to sell a $50,000 package. And so to really go, those things that all those marketers told me is like the way to make money, they do not work for me for whatever reason. And so I am solely focused on what we do really well, which is helping entrepreneurs build authority. And, you know, it's very hard to grow the business up, because if we're doing 12 books a year, if we do 100, the quality is going to go down. Right. So how do you grow sideways? And so that's something I've really been focused on, which is we don't just build authority through books. We can also do it by helping you get on podcasts. We can do it by helping you with your social media. We can do it by helping you get on stages. And so really looking at what we do almost less as book publishing and more as authority building.
Yeah. That's a brilliant approach too.
Took a long time to get there.
It always does, right? Like the best stuff never comes easily. It takes so much blood, sweat, and tears to go, oh, yeah, I feel like I've had one of those sort of aha moments going into this year too, of like really almost scaling down to scale up, you know, yeah. Really simplifying things, streamlining things, looking at what you're good at, what you're not good at, just like we have to do in life and sobriety. Right. I have to really embrace the things I'm good at that feel good and, you know, get as much help as I can with the things that don't come so naturally. Anna, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I love what you're doing. It's so inspirational. And I appreciate you taking the time to come on and share your journey with us.
I am so grateful to you for having me. You are so delightful. And I just feel like we're like simpatico. I love it.
Yeah. Amen to that. I might be hiring you for my book project.
Hell yeah. Thank you again. Thanks anyone for listening.
Thank you.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.